You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and we are now in our second hour. Our guest is Pete Hendrickson, but we have a caller, Jim. And Jim has filed, apparently, more than once, I think, the type of return that we're really supposed to file. I want to remind everyone that the income tax return is actually a document provided to all of us to remand back the withholding that they have taken for the purpose of whatever they're going to do with it for 1 year. They get this revenue for a year. They borrow it out of our paychecks effectively, and then it's up to us to ask for it back. And we have that right every year to file a return, which is our testimony about our taxable activities. Yet the brainwash that's gone on for decades is that this is required, and income tax is a fact of life that everyone has to live with. So Jim was telling us about his 2006 hassles, I believe. He's one of the few that has gotten hassled.
Jim, I want to, before you continue, and I want you to continue, but I want to ask something of you. Would it be safe to say, based on the resistance that you've gotten to your filings, that they could be characterized as amounting to a refusal on the part of the tax agencies to understand what you have done or what you have said, a pretense that they just don't understand what you said?
Well, yeah, probably.
I mean, typically what I see when people forward me things like this is they will have filed something and the agency will write back and say, well, Mr. Jones, you're saying that your wages aren't income. But that's simply wrong, sir. Your wages are income, and so, you know, please, you know, reverse yourself and file a different return. When, of course, what Mr. Smith said was not at all that his wages weren't income. He said he didn't have wages. Two different things. That, I presume, is probably the experience that you've had.
Well, yeah, and it's a constant, you know, trying to convince you that you're wrong and to change your sworn testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and, you know, it's amazing when I send something back to them, I don't get a response back from them.
Right.
In fact, I found it interesting this morning. Let me get back to my 2006 because, you know, okay, they've got my tax return. It's been acknowledged that, I mean, they've got it.
Do they have your money too, Jim?
Just I'm sorry?
Side question.
I'm sorry?
Do they have some money of yours too?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So the latest thing that happened was they sent a form out to the business I work with and asking for information about what my income and taxes withheld were, and which has gotten me into an argument with the owner. Which I believe it's just it's a form of harassment is what it is. They've already got the information.
That's right. Didn't that business owner already send exactly, you know, the allegations that are being relied on here? Didn't they already send them in?
Well, sure. Yeah. So, you know, it's a silly game. Interesting enough, I called this morning to talk to him and ask him where my money was for 2006. And I was going to speak to him about this little harassment.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, after twice being put on hold for 5 minutes, the gentleman came back and said, I'm sorry, but our the whole computer systems are all locked up right now. You're going to have to call us back.
Indeed.
Well,
we'd rather not take your call, sir.
We're coming up on our little break of 3 minutes, so please stay with us, Jim, because this is very interesting to me. Thank you. You're listening to Expansion on the RBN Network, www.republicbroadcasting.org, and I have Pete Hendrickson today as my guest. This is Sophia, your host, and we have a caller, Jim, who has had experience with the hassle that the IRS sometimes gives to people. Jim, you were telling us that they told you that their computers were all down and you were going to have to call them again.
Sure.
So this is typical. They are really dodging their the reality of it, it seems.
Right.
Oh, that absolutely is. Sophia. In fact, a very common thing for people to get that don't simply get immediate lawful treatment in regard to a filing is a 45-day letter, which many are posted as elements of the Every Which Way But Loose page episodes that I referred to earlier in the show. These are letters where the service asks for more time to figure out what to do about the filing that it is reluctant to simply honor as it is supposed to under the law. And sometimes those letters can be issued over and over and over and over again. I have in fact one case study posted amongst the Every Which Way But Loose page episodes in which an educated couple went through 18 months of these 45-day letters, including threats, the frivolous assertions, the notices of levy, in fact, based on the proposition that the frivolous penalties were going to apply, and so on for months and months and months, a year and a half, and finally their check arrived. And other episodes similar to that, over and over, communications in an effort to induce the filer to change their mind, to reverse themselves, to get back in the fold, get back in the pen, and the person stood their ground and ultimately received a closing notice to that notice of deficiency, received their money. It's a game in many ways. It's a nasty little game. It's a near criminal, not quite, but near criminal game that goes on as this enormous invested industry attempts to protect its gravy train. But it is a game.
Which is why it's called the Internal Revenue Service, because it exists. It's not a law firm, as you say somewhere on your website, and I'm looking for that.
Sure. No, it's not a law firm. It's not a court. It's a collection agency and an accounting department. That's what it is.
Right. And they use they are very well trained in psychology, obviously. And it seems to me, Pete, from some of the conversations I've had with you and some of these radio shows, that you unfortunately have to put on the hat of psychologist as well.
Yep.
As you try to invite millions of people into recognizing the reality of what's available to them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Again, as we observed earlier more than once, there is this enormous conditioning that is in play, that is embedded in the minds of Americans, and it has to be overcome for people to take the first step. You know, recognizing that there's a problem is the first step in getting free of an addiction. And in this case, there's an addiction to ignorance, and the comfort that is associated with not fighting when a parasite is having its way with you. And
I had another question for you, Pete, and that is, can they use delay tactics long enough that the 3-year period expires for which during which you can get money back?
No, once the 3-year statute relates to the time in which the claim can be made, not the time that is involved in enforcing the claim or prosecuting the claim. That's actually under a different protocol. Once a claim has been made by way of a tax return, a 1040, then there is a 6-month clock that runs, and if that return is not honored or explicitly disallowed, 6-month period, a 2-year window opens up in which a lawsuit can be filed to enforce the claim.
And who's the they can file a lawsuit against you.
That's the window for you to file a lawsuit against them.
Oh, I see.
To claim the refund that you have claimed by way of the proper form. You can't go to court and do a suit unless you have filed the claim, first of all. But once that claim has been filed and the 6-month opportunity for the tax agencies to respond as provided by law passes, then there's a 2-year window that opens up for filing suit.
And this does not apply to the amended return, because the amended return consists of your having already filed one return to which you've sworn, and then you correct that in an amended return. You say, you know, I was wrong, and here's my amended return. I want that clarified as well.
Same protocols apply. The difference, the key difference, is that there isn't a statutory provision for an amended return. There isn't any public act that says, or public law that says, the Secretary of the Treasury must provide an opportunity for a filer to amend a previous filing, and, you know, here are the rules that are associated with that, here are the limits or what have you. That is left to the latitude of the Secretary of the Treasury, and the Secretary of the Treasury has provided for these amended filings, and so that opportunity exists. But the issue of the claim for refund becomes the same process, presuming that an amended return ends up resulting, and, you know, when the calculations are done on it, it ends up resulting in a claim for the return of property. Then again, there's a 6-month window. Then we get back to the, once the claim has been filed, then these are the steps. And the 2-year window, by the way, is a standard civil suit window. And, you know, when it's not just limited to the tax subject. Any tort or civil claim has a two-year limitation.
Pete, when does that clock actually start ticking? Because that's what they've done to me, but I still haven't got my 2005 back, and they filed a notice of deficiency on me.
Well, you can't count on what I'm going to say here, because I'm not a tax attorney or a CPA or whoever would be considered the, you know, legitimate authority for making declarations about this sort of thing. But as I read the law, from the date that the claim is filed, which is to say the return on, you know, that ends up in a calculation resulting in a, you know, this is how much of my property that had been withheld or whatever or paid in that I believe comes back to me. From the date that claim is made, 6 months for a definitive satisfaction or a definitive disallowance, at which point there are other protocols that become available for contesting the disallowance, one of which is the suit, by the way. If 6 months passes without those two things, one of those two things happening, then the 2-year window is initiated. If there's a disallowance, by the way, that also starts the 2-year clock. So even if within the 6-month period there's a disallowance, then again, 2 years starts to contest that.
Yeah, I didn't get my first response until from my 2005 until 10 months later.
Sure. And as a consequence, you know, the door is open as long as we haven't exhausted, you know, that 2-year period hasn't been exhausted. The door is open for that suit.
So what is the rate of success on the amended return? Do you have any idea based on your...
I don't have any way of tracking that because, of course, I don't know how many people have attempted it, how many people have filed amended returns making claims, reversing their previous filings and seeking a refund. All I can say is that I have many successes, victories posted based on amended returns. It's a much, much smaller number than those posted that are based on original returns. And as I said a little while ago, because there isn't a statutory provision specifically establishing an amended return process, I think that that is a more readily resisted approach. And in fact, there actually is case law to the effect that once an original return has been filed in which an amount of income has been declared, any taxes collected on the basis of that declaration cannot be recovered by suit. It is considered that one has voluntarily sworn to the receipt of that much, you know, quote-unquote income, and that, at that point it's a done deal as far as a remedy in court is concerned. And that has to provide the tax agencies with a feeling of great latitude as far as, you know, resisting amended returns is concerned. But, again, there are many that are posted, and some going back a long, long ways, they don't involve claims for refund because there is a 3-year limit as to how far back one can go from the time that an amount was collected to reclaim it. But there isn't any statute of limitations as far as going back to correct the evidentiary record upon which allegations of liability might be based. And so I have some circumstances in which these amendments have gone back many years.
We are entering our 3-minute window for a break, and we'll be back on the other side.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest is Pete Hendrickson.
Who wants to amend something he just said, Sophia, if you don't mind.
Yes.
I was talking about the amended returns there, and I kind of let a sort of a parallel concept intrude into my thinking as I was talking about going back. It isn't possible to go back past the 3-year limit on an amendment. An amended return specifically, and I implied that I think that people had gone back beyond that point. That is not the case. People have filed returns going back many, many years, well beyond 3 years, unable to collect the return of property that had been withheld or paid in by them, subject to the 3-year limit, which is where I let myself conflate two concepts there and make what really amounted to kind of a misstatement. But the correction of the record without there being an opportunity to claim the refund, but to eliminate and rebut evidence upon which an alleged liability exists, has gone back many, many years, in some cases actually into the 80s for that purpose. So the statutes of limitations work within their own contexts, and in some respects, there effectively aren't any.
Why would you want to fix or amend a return that was that old? I'm just trying to...
Well, again, that was the nature of my misstatement. It isn't that you can amend a return that old, but to correct the record in cases in which, typically these would be cases in which no filing had ever been made.
Yes.
But an allegation of liability was being based on consequently unrebutted testimony about the receipt of income that was in the record. In other words, someone had created allegations about one's receipt of income. They had gone unanswered because the individual had not filed a return responding to those allegations. And consequently, a liability was presumed to exist based on those unanswered allegations. And that liability, if it isn't ultimately satisfied, will continue to be pressed for collection against someone unless and until they go back and correct that record and rebut that evidence on which the allegation is based. And that has been done going back, as I said, many, many years, there being no effective limitation to that reach back or look back.
So in the case of filing an amended return, a person really would do that and want to reclaim money, I'm talking about, because they had been made a fool of. They had unwittingly given the IRS a bunch of money based on this misconception that their CPAs and bookkeepers and H&R Block and so forth have told them about. And it's part of our culture now. So if you go back and file an amended return, I read on your website, I followed one of those postings, and it seemed that the more the filer reminded the IRS agency or agents of the law, eventually they broke down and did return the money on
yes.
1040X. So that can work, right?
No question about it.
So it just seems to me rather interesting, and I always like to observe human nature. What do these agents then start to think when, you know, are they operating independently, Pete, when they give you a refund? How does it work? Do you have any idea?
You ask a great question there, Sophia. This is something that has puzzled me for a long time as to how aware the vast numbers of staffers at these tax agencies are of the realities of the law. I, for a long time, believed firmly that virtually none of them had the vaguest notion about how the law really worked and what it really said and so forth. I can't believe that continues to be true today, because there are, frankly, tens of thousands of CTC-educated Americans out there who are inundating these tax agencies with educated filings, and in a number of cases, corresponding with them back and forth, dealing with initial efforts to resist the filings, with in many cases extremely articulate and pointed correspondences and phone conversations and so forth, laying the law out in detail for the listener. And so some of these people are getting an education perforce just by virtue of engaging in their own bad behavior. So many of them know at this point. On the other hand, this is a bureaucracy, and it's the ultimate bureaucracy, and they have this enormous Internal Revenue Manual that has an instruction for every circumstance, or so it would like to imagine, anyway. And most of these folks are basically just pencil pushing 9-to-5ers, and they look at the book and see, well, what am I supposed to do now, without giving a whole lot of thought to what it is that they're responding to and why it is that they're going to do whatever the book says that they're supposed to do. So it's a mixed bag. Certainly more and more of them know what's going on. What that does to them the next time they have to deal with a situation like this is the interesting question that you raise. I think that we're still waiting to see.
And we have our 3-minute break, and we'll be back on the other side. And I have more questions, Pete, as always.
Very good.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Expansion on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, at www.republicbroadcasting.org. And this is Sophia, your host, and I have Pete Hendrickson today as my guest, clarifying more things about how wonderfully we can file our income tax returns and not be working for the IRS, which is what we're doing when we pay those taxes. There is a caller on the line now, Mike from Illinois. Mike, are you there?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Hi. Are you?
Okay, how are you doing? Hey, Pete, I got your book a couple years ago, but I've been hesitant on filing because I wasn't sure that I knew what I was doing. I was wondering, is there any help on that to talk to somebody about help doing it, or?
Well, there, yes and no.
Yeah.
You know, each individual is responsible for the content of their own testimony. And
right.
So, you know, nobody can write things in for anyone else and to, you know, fill out forms for anyone else.
Right.
And certainly no one can sign those forms for anyone else. It's the individual
right.
that takes responsibility for these things. However, in addition to just the contents of the book, and I know that, you know, the paradigm shift that's involved here is dramatic. This is a sort of an everything you ever knew about this subject was wrong kind of transformational change. One thing that I will say is reread the book.
I can't remember whether you mentioned. See, I haven't filed, and if you mention what the proper form is, if you don't file at all, if you haven't filed, and you need to go back and file.
Well, nothing changes in terms of the forms that are used, and in fact, you know, it might be worth noting at this point that the actual forms that are used are not really critically important. It's the testimony that's important. It's the content of the testimony. And in fact, you know, one can file a return and do it that does all the things that a 1040 does without actually using a 1040. but the 1040, of course, has everything that is necessary to be legally meaningful already laid out for someone. So it certainly is the most convenient mechanism.
And how far back can they prosecute you for? I mean, because obviously you probably just need to really go back that far to file amendment.
How far back can they prosecute you for what?
Yeah.
For what?
For willful failure to file.
Oh. I don't know. There probably is a statute of limitations on that. Maybe it's a 5-year. That's pretty typical for that sort of thing. But I can't say that I ever specifically looked, because that's not a subject much on my mind. Certainly they can go back some number of years. For that, and you know, the question at that point is, why would anyone not file? You know, all that does is cause one to testify by default. It's acquiescence by silence to whatever has been alleged about someone.
May I make a statement here, please?
Go, Sophia.
I think that what we have to bring into the discussion is whether or not there are these testimonials filed about you by others. If in any given year someone has issued a 1099 or a W-2 with your name on it, then you have to answer to those charges, right?
That's exactly right. That's what I meant by testifying by default. If someone else has made an allegation about an individual, that individual either responds to correct, acknowledge, or rebut that allegation, or they say nothing, in which case they are acknowledging that allegation by default, and that whatever that testimony was that was made about them stands as established. And so if that testimony, a W-2, a 1099, a K-1, et cetera, has been created that says, you know, Joe Smith received, you know, $100,000 in income, quote-unquote, in 2007, and Joe Smith never says anything to the contrary, that allegation is going to be taken as true, and Joe Smith is going to end up getting a bill, a tax bill saying, well, you know, everybody's in agreement that you did $100,000 worth of taxable activity, and that there is a you know, 10% or 15% or whatever tax on that. Here's your bill for that tax. That's how it works.
Yeah, I haven't. Like I said, I haven't filed in about 18 years or so, and they tried levying my wages a couple times, and I just wrote a response letter to them that basically, you know, the levy obviously is, you know, goes to section, I think, 3201A or something like that, where it explains who it applies to.
6331.
That's right, 6331. Right, it says it right on the back, and they leave out that section A on their levy.
Yeah, which actually only, you know, the distinction there is to whom a notice of levy, or, you know, against whom a notice of levy can be used. It isn't a limitation as to who a levy can apply to. A levy can apply
right.
to anybody that
yeah.
is been established to be liable for a tax, and
right.
anybody could be established to be liable for a tax. But only certain types of individuals can have a notice of levy suffice as the mechanism. So that's the limitation. It isn't a limitation on the power to levy. It's a limitation on the power to levy by notice. You still there, Mike? Yes. Sophia, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Okay, I think Mike dropped out there.
Yes. Well, I think people have to bear in mind that they're not free if somebody says something about them. That's, to me, it's boiling this down, that makes it really crystal clear.
Sure, that's absolutely correct. And in fact, the reverse of that also helps clarify matters, too. Unless testimony has been made about someone, this all becomes kind of a non-issue. It's just moot. There is a dynamic in play here. There's a sort of a little mini legal contest going on in regard to the tax with everybody all the time. When someone else has made allegations, then that raises the opportunity and the necessity of responding, reacting. Of course, if you know property has been withheld from someone, that's the really the starting point of the whole thing. But the normal process, the normal progress of events is the allegation and a response. Reclaiming property is a separate thing.
Pete, you have a second book called Upholding the Law.
Yes.
I have not read that book. Can you tell
me? Oh, I'm hurt.
Well, don't cry. I'll get one. I'll get one immediately and read it. What is Upholding the Law about?
Upholding the Law is two things, really. First of all, let me say that it's a collection of 27 independent essays. They focus on three different things, I guess. A batch of them are studies of other aspects of constitutional law beyond the income tax, and I discuss gun control, the underlying legal realities of gun control, and federal drug laws, and speech issues, and law related to the Fourth Amendment, jury authority, and so forth. Another batch deals with issues of public policy, foreign relations, federal authority and education, and the issues about making what I believe are wise choices in some of these areas, and then the other percentage of the book is intended to be and focuses on being inspirational. The object of which is to let people understand or encourage people to understand that the Constitution does not defend itself, it doesn't enforce itself, it relies on individuals doing what we started this program with, standing up on their own feet and taking responsibility for themselves and for what befalls them, for their course in life, and recognizing that the founders, as Ben Franklin, famously said when asked, after stepping outside the convention hall at the birth of the Constitution, what have you given us, Mr. Franklin? A republic, if you can keep it. And the object is to help encourage people to keep it, to do what's necessary to keep it, to keep the law, to keep the rule of law, to uphold the rule of law, and have that continue to be a functioning reality in our lives.
Yes, well, as I said before, we have to be the ones that stand up and figure out how to walk and participate in this. We have another caller on the line, Bill from Idaho.
Hey, Bill.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello.
Hey, Bill, are you there?
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello. I was wondering, I'm trying to... I'm not sure whether you could hear me or not.
I can hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to thank you both and everybody that participates in these forums so very much for everything they do each day for the Republic. And
thank you for being there,
inimical to total success. And considering the track record of those that would usurp presumed authorities, if not abuses, upon their employers. It was the question, considering these times would be those times, it would seem that the gentleman that called was way better prepared than even he believed. And yet at the same time, considering that we had a good, kindly Buddhist monk here, a parliamentarian from the Dalai Lama as well, that 30 people arrived to listen to his request for nonviolence, and the danger that this continued alliance and or inveigled contract portends as time plays out for posterity. Is there an opportunity within the community to cause a large enough shout that they can't be ignored, considering we have all of ours obviously as prisoners of war or worse?
That's a broad question, Bill, but and I don't know that I can respond to it. Maybe Sophia has something else to say, but I would say this. There's no shout's going to get heard until it gets made. And the American people have so far, given it a shot. When the bailout bill was first, in its three pages format, and the people responded to the proposition that this thing was going to be fastened upon us, they shouted big time. And the best quote I heard about this was some U.S. representative who said, "My email is running 50-50 on this subject. 50% says no, and 50% says hell no."
Exactly.
And that was how it was. But then, 4 days later, our public servants just quietly did it anyway. Although they waited until they had larded it up with 400 pages of perks, for their own special interests. But that wasn't a great deal of a shout. It people may have felt that they were making themselves heard, but it's possible to shout a whole lot louder than that, and I think that it's necessary. Sophia, you have anything else to, different opinion or what have you?
Well, to the point of the question, considering that this would be but the air battle for Britain and the whole entire game in perspective of history, when it comes time for April 16th again, and the econometrics internationally for the mothers and the children that are presently dying of starvation and divorce, any more than the peaceful Pacific Tibetans that would avoid all violence righteously and yet still consider the slings and arrows, would there be an automation or a capability, being a Luddite, that I would be the worst and the most fallen, that there would be an automation that could be linked to the system to speed and ease? These little sheepies will go fleet every Sunday, as long as they absolutely believe that the line of least resistance does not ensure them for dinner.
I'm going to just thank you very much for calling, Bill.
Yeah.
I want to just bring in a couple of things before we're closing in about 10 minutes' time. So, Pete, I'd like to ask you this. Our last caller, I believe his name was Mike, said that he had read your book, and he was afraid to act on it because he wasn't really sure he knew what he was doing.
Yes, and frankly, perhaps wisely so, based on a couple of things in his conversation that revealed not quite understanding some important principles
yes.
that are laid out in the book.
Right. Well, first of all, that the other test that the testimonies are made about you by others. Now, Pete, I want to suggest to our listening audience that groups be formed. I have created the simplified website, notincome.com, on which these concepts are laid out. And then from that website, you can go to Pete's website and explore them in much greater depth. But there is also this income tax fact sheet that is available
yes.
that, Pete, you've been very kind to promote a little bit.
Oh, it's an excellent introductory tool and
yes.
an outreach tool.
And I think that if people get a supply of the fact sheets, which can be bought at notincome.com, even 50 of them, and you start passing them around, and you engage the interest of your friends and neighbors and family in this issue, you can do this all as a small group, and there's an awful lot of comfort to be gotten from other people doing it with you, because they are taking the same risk.
No question about that. On that front, Sophia, let me mention that there are 49 CTC organizations, one in each of 48 states, and then there's a national forum organization as well that enable people to correspond and socialize with CTC-educated people in their home states, and that parallels this concept, I think, to a certain degree.
Yes,
but you're absolutely right that that kind of action is very helpful, very useful. It's invigorating, and it's self-sustaining.
Yes, and we're going for our short break, and then we have 10 minutes left to discuss this. RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is Expansion with Sophia, your host. And I'm concluding another show with one of my favorite guests, Pete Hendrickson, only because he inspires me to hurry up and file something every time I talk to him. I wish there were more that I could file, you know. Anyway, Pete, I wanted to get back to the issue of doing this in groups. It's very, very comforting to do it with somebody else.
No question about it.
And I think that people can, I mean, of course, there's April. Everyone says, oh, well, I won't worry about it until January or February. But I really think that that's late to become educated. I started to become educated in February only because that was when someone told me, Pete Hendrickson is the guy, and read his book. And then I had to rush to, like, immerse myself in this new thinking, and it was stressful to do it that fast. So there's no better day than today to get cracking the code. Read it, and as Pete says, read it again. Get the income tax fact sheet cards. I sound like a salesperson here, but seriously, there are steps to this, and the steps are about immersion. The easiest, most relaxing way to start something that is going to begin very stressfully for most people. Don't you agree, Pete?
Absolutely true, and particularly I want to emphasize what you said about not waiting until the hour is upon you. This is overcoming the conditioning is a slow process for some folks. It requires reading the same thing over and over again sometimes. In the case of those who just, you know, can't believe something based on immediate evidence and perceptions, they want to go explore, they want to, you know, look at lots of things, and that may take a month or two. So certainly don't wait until the last minute. And in any event, you know, as I said when we began the program today, there's more to this than just the income tax as well. Understanding the reality of the income tax shines a light on every other relationship that an American has with his or her government. And those things, you know, it once was well said back in the back around the turn of the 20th century that at that time and up to that time, an American could go their entire lives without ever encountering a federal official other than the person that delivered their mail. That was the only contact they had with a federal person. Today, we have contact with federal people weekly, in one way or another. One way or another, the central entity has intruded itself into all of our lives, and mostly for the worse. Understanding that relationship, the true legal nature of that relationship, and you know who's got power and how it is exercised, is really important. Knowing the truth about the tax. In fact, cracking the code, for that matter, really doesn't exclusively deal with the income tax. It deals with, more fundamentally, the issue of that relationship, which happens to then lead to the reality of the tax. So I absolutely encourage people to start soon. There's an immediate benefit to be had, even before April 16th shows up.
Well, yeah, you've got to get this through your head. You have to really, like, take your hat off and put it on again.
Yep.
And I just want to gush a little bit about Pete now so you can become embarrassed. But I have to say, Pete, you are extremely brilliant and extremely brave. And you are such an asset to this country to have done what you've done and have put it out there for people to get informed with.
You're way too kind, Sophia, and I'm blushing furiously.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming back to the show, Pete.
And always a pleasure.
You will be back many times.
Sounds good.
All right.
Bye-bye.